Thank you, Dave. It's a pleasure to be here. I'm wired on both sides, and then so I see somebody's putting up yet another mic. So I hope I don't trip on all the cords that I have attached to me. Before I begin my presentation, I would like to invite you to join my email newsletter. I send out a newsletter about once a week, and I have a little sign-up sheet for anyone who care to sign up. You just give me your name, your email address, and your phone number. The phone number is only in case we can't read your handwriting. Don't worry, no salesman will call you. So if you and that e-newsletter basically gives you my commentary and where I'm going to be speaking and things like that for the week. So again, I won't clutter your inbox, just like Dave said. Once a week, you might hear from me. Okay, so today, our first topic is to talk about cohabitation. And what I really want to talk with you about, the announced topic is why cohabitation is not the same as marriage. And I've decided to entitle these remarks, Myths of Cohabitation and Marriage. Now, we know that here in Canada, cohabitation is a growing phenomenon. It's a growing phenomenon across all of the industrialized countries. But these figures are just from the report of Statistics Canada, which came out just a few weeks ago, that the proportion of common law families has increased dramatically over the past two decades, as well as the proportion of lone parent families has been increasing. And here are the little charts that came out of Statistics Canada. The married couple family with children age 24 and under is still the largest family structure in Canada, but the numbers are declining. As you can see from the chart over here, these are the married couples with children going from 1996 to 2006. Married couples without children, childlessness is a growing phenomenon. And then down in here is the development of common law couples. And you can see that common law couples with children, common law couples without children, these are the growing trends in family formation here in Canada, as I must say is the case in the US and probably the UK and Sweden and many other countries. Once again, this is another set of statistics from Statistics Canada about 6 weeks ago this material came out, and the proportion of children under 24 or age under 14 in this chart who are living with both of their married parents, that continues to decline. We're not in desperate straits. It's still the case that two-thirds of children are living with married parents as of this census date, but it's still the case that this is something that's declining. So it's something that we need to be paying attention to and ask ourselves, does it matter? Do we care whether kids are living with cohabiting couple or married couple? Does this matter? Now, what we have, I would say, in front of us are a set of myths. We have some myths about marriage. We have some myths about cohabitation. And what I'm going to do in my presentation is to try to unpack some of those myths. Because it's all well and good to say everyone should choose to do what they like. Everyone should do whatever's right for them. That's all well and good to say. That's a very important part of our Anglo-American tradition of liberty. But of course, if you understate the harms of one of the choices and systematically overstate the harms of the other choice and then say, okay, dear, choose whatever you like, you know, it's a little bit unfair, right? So let's talk briefly. I'm going to give you an overview of some of these myths that will be exploding. The myths of marriage, and I think everybody recognizes these as things which are out there in the public square. Women can be trapped in dangerous and abusive marriages. This is something brought to you by the feminist movement. All men are in danger of all men threaten all women with rape at all times, I think is a direct quote from one of our American feminists. Marriage can be an emotional trap for people, and marriage is just too much financial responsibility. I don't want to get involved. I don't want to commit myself financially. Now, each of these has some plausibility to them, and this is why they take hold. I mean, after all, people went around spreading an idea that was completely implausible. Nobody would go for it. But since everybody knows that marriage can be difficult emotionally, since everybody knows somebody who's had some of these problems, it has an air of plausibility about it. And so the question is, compared to what? Okay, women can be trapped in dangerous marriages compared to what? That's what we want to start to ask ourselves. Now, on the other side, we have the idea out there that cohabitation is a good thing. Cohabitation has certain advantages. Cohabitation is a good thing because we'll figure out whether we're compatible. We'll avoid divorce if we find out that we aren't compatible. It's better to just break up a cohabiting relationship. That will be less painful and more and less difficult to break a cohabiting relationship than to actually go through getting a divorce. And in the end, we'll have a better marriage. I think this is one of the ideas that people have, that if they live together first, they will have a better marriage in the end, that this will somehow be something that promotes marriage. And often this thought, this whole set of thoughts, is summarized with the almost joke of, well, gosh, you wouldn't buy a car without taking it for a test drive, so we really ought to take each other for a test drive and find out whether we're really compatible. And so I'll have some things to say about that. And in fact, there's a little article in your packet called that, Why Not Take Her for a Test Drive? And I'll point that out to you, that is something of all the things I've written over the last 10 years. That one has probably been reprinted more times than anything I've ever done. And if any of you are involved with nonprofit organizations or service organizations, you may reprint it in your newsletter too if you would like to. And so you just need to let me know that you're doing that, and I will certainly give free permission to do that. Okay, now behind these myths, the myths of marriage, and what I would call the not just the myths of cohabitation, but the fantasy, it's really kind of a fantasy that people have about what cohabitation will really be like, there's a kind of implicit theory in it, okay? Behind the scenes, in the back of their minds, which they're not exactly articulating, is a theory, a whole theory about what marriage is and isn't. And the idea is that marriage is just a piece of paper. Marriage, it's just a piece of paper. It doesn't make any difference. Have any of you ever heard this? It's just a piece of paper. And, you know, sometimes when I'm doing talk radio, I'll have a caller call in and say, oh, it's just a piece of paper. I love my girlfriend. We're living together. And, you know, there's an obvious response to that, which I've given on the radio, and that is, well, gee, buddy, if it's really just a piece of paper, go on down to City Hall and get the piece of paper. Make the girl feel better, you know. Go do it. And if you catch the slightest bit of resistance from the guy at that point, that is your clue. That is not just a piece of paper, right? That there's actually something there that's bothering him that is creating that resistance to just going and getting the piece of paper. Now, the other part of the implicit theory is that marriage is just a contract between consenting adults. And so, you know, we can contract for anything we want. If we want a 5-year renewable term contract, that's fine. If we don't want a contract that allows us to bring in dancing girls and for me to have a side relationship or whatever, if we agree to it, then that's perfectly okay. That's the other part of the implicit theory that people have going through their minds. And so we'll want to take a look at some of that as well. So what I'm going to do here, I'm going to have three topics over the course of our half hour together. And first I want to examine a little bit this implicit theory of marriage. I want to dig behind that a little bit, see if it's as plausible as it seems to be. Secondly, we want to explode the myths of cohabitation and marriage. And then finally, we want to say something about why cohabitation turns out to be so disappointing. Why it is that we don't get the results that we seem to think we ought to be getting. Why that test drive analogy doesn't seem to quite work. Okay, so let's talk briefly about marriage. And I'm very glad that I got to be first this morning because I think some of these remarks will help set the stage for a lot of what we're going to be doing during the day. And that is that I think marriage is a difficult topic because it needs to be understood at least three different levels. There's this sort of grand theoretical and philosophical level, which is the big picture of what marriage is all about inside a society. Then there's the public policy level, which most of us are interested in, sort of acutely interested in. And then finally, there's the personal level, what I call the kitchen table level, which is that most people either are married, have been married, know somebody who's married, grew up with married parents. Most people have opinions about marriage. Most people have some kind of experience themselves. And I would propose that what public policy has to say and what your theory or your philosophy about marriage is, those things are going to impinge upon how well you do it around the kitchen table. In other words, if you're walking around with a theory that's untenable, you're going to have a lot of trouble over breakfast. That's just how it's going to turn out because you're going to be trying to do things that are counterproductive and they're going to make you unhappy and they're going to make your spouse unhappy. So you really have to deal with marriage at all three of these levels to really get get it right. And I would say that in our Western society today, we have trouble at all three of these levels. Because we don't grasp what marriage is really about, we're making bad public policies. Those public policies, in turn, undermine our abilities to actually have a functioning, happy, comfortable life around the dinner table. And so we have to take some awareness of all of them. So let's just take a moment to take that grand philosophical view of what marriage is all about and why it's important and some of the things that we're getting wrong about it. Now, as Dave mentioned, I've written a couple of books on this topic. The first one is called Love and Economics, Why the Laissez-Faire Family Doesn't Work. And I should mention that these books are available at the back of the table, at the table at the back of the room, and we can talk about that at the break. The subtitle of my first book is Why the Laissez-Faire Family Doesn't Work. The title of my second book is Smart Sex, Finding Lifelong Love in a Hookup World. Now, I have to tell you, if you write a book with these kind of titles, you have to think about what you're saying. If you write a book called Smart Sex, that kind of presupposes there's something called dumb sex, right? There's an opposite to that. And if you write a book called Why the Laissez-Faire Family Doesn't Work, that kind of says that there are some things that work, some things that don't work. And so before I begin in all of the academic stuff, which is very comfortable to talk about statistics and research and so on, I have to make an uncomfortable admission and tell you how it is that I got to be an expert on dumb things that don't work, which is that I have tried all these harebrained things which I write about, which is how I know that they don't work. Okay? As Dave mentioned in the introduction, I was a committed career woman before having children, and for me what that meant was to get on that fast track, get the PhD, which is in economics, which is a male-dominated field. You have the whole idea that, by golly, you're going to get out there and you're going to work hard and you're going to prove yourself and yada, yada, yada. And my plan for myself was that I would, once I got tenure, I would have a child during the summer, then put the baby in daycare and go back to work in September. And I'm so glad to see you all laughing over that, because when I tell this kind of story on a college campus, which I do quite frequently, the students are all sitting there going, yeah, then what happened? You know, they don't get that that's funny. You know, they don't see the problem with thinking that you have everything all under control like that. But anyway, so the short version of what happened is what Dave told you, is that we had, actually he didn't mention, we had a 4-year infertility crisis, which was, the baby didn't show up during the month I had set aside for it. That turned out to be a whole spiritual crisis for me, because it was the first time in my adult life that I couldn't get what I wanted just by working harder, you see. And so therefore I had to rethink a lot of things around that. But I won't detain you with that. Just as Dave mentioned, we ended up having 2 children in 6 months' time, which is a record even for a Catholic. And it was, you know, kind of a lot to deal with. But the main thing, I want to tell you something that happened before that, which is that my husband and I did live together before we got married. And we had the whole kind of private property approach to our life together, you know, which is that we will avoid conflict if we have everything separate. And our idea was that the contract is the way that adult people deal with each other, and that's how free people who are equals deal with one another, is through bargains and contracts and so on. So we'll have separate bank accounts. We'll know what belongs to whom within the household. We bought a house that way. We got a dog that way. The house was jointly owned. The dog was my personal property. And that's the way we thought, okay? That's the way we thought. That's the way we approached it. Now, we eventually did get married, but we had all this whole thought process, you know, that this was going to be a good thing to live together first. The reality was, however, that we were scared. Say, we were scared of marriage. That was the real truth. We were scared of the commitment. And it was only when our backs were to the wall that we decided we better get married. And then once our children came, as you can imagine from Dave's description, our children made demands upon us that were unlike anything we had ever had to deal with before. Okay, and that's true of all families and all children. You know, the first child is always a shock, I think, particularly to people who have these kind of modern ideas. It's a shock to find out, for instance, that gender roles are real. you know, and that moms and dads actually behave differently and stuff like that. People who are really committed to feminist ideology have a real hard time with their first child because the baby just throws everything into disarray. So we had two children, one of whom was quite needy, who was quite disabled in many ways. And so it required a lot of cooperation from us. It required us to cooperate with one another on a level that we were not used to, on a level that we had never been asked to do. Nothing in our lives had asked us to do that before. We had what I would call the married singles lifestyle. Okay, we were married, but we were really singles, you know, to, who happened to live together. So we had what that married singles lifestyle was not going to be enough to see us through the kinds of problems that we were going to be dealing with this, this extremely needy child. We were going to have to, and I say that advisedly, our son was extremely needy, our daughter was extremely easy. I consider the whole thing an act of grace, you know, just we were completely graced to have these two children, because if we had only had my daughter, we could have gotten away with this whole crazy plan. You know, she would have been a child you could put in daycare and she would come home with a big vocabulary. She would have been fine in daycare. I might have gotten away with it, in other words, if it had just been her. But because we had the two of them, who were very different and very, and one much more needy than the other, it became necessary to really think through, well, what the heck is marriage all about anyhow? And what the heck is parenthood all about? What are we doing here? And so it became clear to us that we need more kinds of cooperation than just our little contract model was prepared to give us.